accomplish where I got a desire to. And so Charlie and I, we go back to day one, sort of ground zero for me, in the program at Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was really funny because it was the last day of this particular conference. It's the Brazos Riverside Conference. It takes place right outside Lake Whitney, northwest of Waco. And Charlie and I were just having a conversation about motorcycles, and he said, "So, how long have you been in the program?" "Well, I was the guy that got the desire to check that." Charlie and I we're friends, and he's like a brother. I was just telling him this earlier. When we gather together as recovered people, it's a pretty big deal. And, so Charlie and I are kind of like brothers in that way. And also we've taken some pretty exciting trips on our motorcycles together. We've been up to Sturgis, South Dakota 3 times. And it was always a big, wild adventure, but it was really cool, too, because we weren't drinking. And going to an AA meeting in downtown Sturgis, South Dakota was really pretty awesome. In fact, the first year that we went there, I said, I don't know where the AA place is, but we're going to go find that downtown. I said, come on, let's go. So we went and checked out the sobriety here in Sturgis. Charlie's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He started a group down in South Austin that studies the Big Book. He helps other people. I've been out to the ranch with Charlie. Charlie sponsors people. Charlie stays in the book. Charlie has been responsible for lots of other people staying interested in checking that book out, including me. I always have tried to stay in the book, but when my friend and brother dives in there deeper, I sort of dive in there with him. And I've been carrying that book around all the time, and I'm really believing in that. What that book says, all my answers are in that book. And Charlie's going to delight you guys with his story. So I'd like to welcome to the podium Charlie P.
This is a good-looking bunch. I don't know what kind of folks y'all drank with, but it didn't look like this, right? I'm telling you. Thank you for that warm introduction there, Jim. And before I forget, I want to thank Harris for putting this thing together, and I know he didn't do it by himself, and it's a lot of work that goes into putting all these things together, and one of the things I've learned from hanging around for a while, there's a lot of us that don't do anything to put it together, but we have a lot of better ideas of how it could be done better. I appreciate your work, and I want to thank you for having me up here tonight. There was a lady that said she's at her first AA meeting, and we have a big book here that Katie gave. We want to pass around, and the women put your name and phone number if you'd like in this book, and we'll be sure she gets it before she gets out of here. Everybody in this room that's alcoholic has been to their first AA meeting. I will warn you in advance that I'm a big guy, and I'm liable to cry like a little girl in a pink skirt before this is over. So it doesn't mean that I'm mentally unstable, I don't think. But usually it's just that I'm so grateful for what this program has done for me. And that's what I come up here to talk about. I'm real glad to be here tonight. I wore this coat and tie out of respect for the fellowship and our founding people. And when I was coming up in AA, they always wore a coat and tie to the podium. Now, it feels different to me. When I put on a tie, I feel like I should say, "No contest, Your Honor." I mean, that's just my experience, you know. It's the good-looking bunch. You know, I look around here, and I see my sponsor over there. I see my girlfriend Katie here. I see a lot of people, and you would think that I would be grateful for that kind of support and having the people. All I could think about over there when I was sitting there is that there's at least three people in the room that give a better talk than I do. You know, I'm really grateful to be up here tonight. And you know, this thing, I don't know if many of you know the history, but that we used to have a thing. It's funny, I thought of this get-together. I didn't have anything to do with putting it together, but I thought of it. I used to say that I could just release an idea into the universe, and that my higher power was so strong that he would just produce it, you know. All I had to do was release the idea into the universe. Well, pretty good stuff. I was down in South Austin one day, and I was at Living Faith, you know, and when you go to Living Faith, you see the Living Faith crowd, and when you go to Western Trails, you'd see the Western Trails crowd. When you go to Westlake, you know, and so on, Cedar Park Hope Group, Northland. And I said, you know, we should have a group where everybody gets together, you know, so you could see everybody, you know, from all the groups. I said, because there's people you never see. That's just one of those little trains of thought that comes rolling through my little Grand Central Station brain. And about 3 days later, I was at a club, and somebody goes, are you going to the intergroup meeting this weekend? And I was like, wow. That was fast, you know. It doesn't always happen that fast, you know. And so, of course, a lot of people put a lot of work into it in the meantime, but I just, you know, I heard about it 3 days after. It's kind of like the way Al Gore invented the Internet, you know. I didn't have a lot of activity, and I'm not going to get in any outside issues up here. But I do think it's a great idea, and we used to do it back in the 90s and get people together And then I was lucky enough to get to speak at one of those one time, too. But then it just kind of fell off the table. And it just goes to show you that, you know, if you can be in AA and one or two people that take action and take initiative can really have a big effect on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen it repeatedly in the time I've been around, is that, you know, if you get an organizer in, you know, in your group, a lot of stuff comes together, you know, where you just, like, I remember at Bolden, when there was Richard Green used to come down there, and, you know, it's like, we're all going tubing this weekend, or we're all going to Wet n Wild, and I'll get to that story. Wet n Wild was a part of my story with my original sponsor. I call him my sponsor emeritus, because Jim Fletcher moved to Arkansas about 6 years ago, and my sponsor, Mark Houston, is here tonight. Shit, that didn't take long. So I get... That's good, so I get emotional and use profanity. All the same thing. You're really doing good now. I love the people in this program. I love drunks. I like being around drunks. I love drunks when I was drinking. I like them being sober. I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to get into my story. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic, and if I can stay sober until this Thursday, I'll have 22 years of sobriety. Friday night has been March 22nd, more than once. I'll get to that a little later. You know, and I got to warn you about one other thing. A lot of times, my brain, I've got a little ADD issue going on up there. And there's a lot of little bunny trails that run out of the brain. And I will say many times that I'll get to that a little later. I'm not going to get to it. You know, I can just warn you in advance. But what it means is this is the wrong time for it to be in the story. But I'm probably not going to get to it later either. You know, I had some ideas about tonight's talk. You know, and I saw the schedule that it said that the speaker talks from 7 to 8:15, and then from 8:15 to 9 o'clock is cleanup. And I've always said that I give three talks whenever I talk. There's the talk. I give a dandy of a talk sitting in that chair over there. And then there's the talk that I give when I'm at the podium. And then there's the talk that I'll give on the rewrite on the drive home tonight. There's something about closing that car door that makes you remember all the stuff that you meant to say. So what I was thinking we'd do is I'll help for the first 30 minutes of the cleanup, and then I'd like to get up for the last 5 minutes and say all the stuff that I forgot to say. And I truly believe in my heart that God is present for one of those talks at least, you know. And my sponsor likes to say that he gets a 15-second warning on what's going to come out of his mouth, and I'm praying for that. Mine's 2 or 3 seconds, I think. But good stuff here. Our book says there's a couple of things in the book that mention our talk, and there's one where it says. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. There's another one on page 50 in this book, but all this is my most prized possession. This is a large print copy of the big book that a friend of mine up in Dallas had leather bound for me. It's not outside literature. It's a large print now that I'm an old man. I love this book, but it says on page 50 in our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. There are questions for each individual to settle for himself. Now listen to this. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. As a celebrated American statesman put it, let's look at the record. I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and was born in 1956. I'm 50 years old today. I mean, not today, but back in November I was 50. And I come from a fairly normal family, you know. You steal lines from everybody. You know? I heard Jim the other day say that normal is the setting on a washing machine. And I thought, that is beautiful, you know. So I don't know how normal the family was, but it was... I've heard enough fifth steps over the years to know that there are a lot of people who had it a hell of a lot worse than I had it. And I grew up in the baby boom. The street that I grew up on had 61 kids on it, on one block. The Messicks had 16 of them, but it was an active block, you know. You remember that when you came, and where the next block was just a world away, you know, and you didn't jack with the people on the next block, you know. And we had our little block, and they had their block, and every once in a while we'd throw rocks across the alley at each other. But anyway, that's when I grew up, and fairly normal family. I do have a sister that's 5 and a half years older than I am. She was a high achiever, tough act to follow, you know, National Honor Society, first chair flautist, drum majorette, drill team, oh, God, you name it, she joined it, you know, and then her little brother, the thug, you know, but the thing about it was my mother was a first grade school teacher, and my mother taught for 42 years, and I was well prepared for the first grade. You know, I mean, I showed up looking good. You know, there's flashcards at the house and all that stuff. And I don't know, I grew up, they talked a lot about potential. You know, I mean, did anybody else suffer under the burden of potential? You know, I mean, why can't you be like Charles Mollier across the street and all this stuff? And it was a lot of potential the one thing I can report to you is that 12 years of drinking and heavy usage of outside issues will significantly lower people's expectations of me. By the time I got to this program, they were like, just get a job, you know. God's sakes, you know, don't worry about a career or a profession or an education or, you know, just get your ass off the couch. You know? You know, because I mean, I'm sitting there, and the high point of my day was when the Three Stooges had come on. And it was always when my parents were getting ready to go to work, and you know, here's their pride and joy, the fat butt boy sitting on the couch watching the Three Stooges. Bye! You know, hey, Mom, pick up some milk, would you? You know, that was a little later in the story, but, I performed pretty well in elementary school. I was holding it together. Damn it, don't laugh. That's been holding it together for a long time. I was doing my best, you know, but I just had this feeling of separation, you know, that we all have. You know, I mean, when we come into this program, one of the reasons I think we need a sponsor that's based in the book is because I got no shot of understanding what's in the book by myself. You know, it's terms I'm not familiar with, it's words that I don't use, it's phrases that just whiz right past me. And I completely forgot why I was saying that. One of the things that they talk about was a spiritual malady. That's what got me on. And, you know, that term never really touched me. You know, I mean, when I hear people say it when I came in here, and if you're new, and it sounds like we're speaking another language, I know exactly what that's like. You know, when they're talking about Mr. Bill and Dr. Bob and this step and that tradition, and, you know, if you're having trouble with your four, you need to go back to your one, and it's probably, you know, if you're in it, and you're like, this tradition, what the hell are they talking about? When a new guy comes in, you know, and we sit through the meeting, and say, are there any newcomers here? And then, if there are, maybe we try to scare the crap out of them with our war stories. And then pat him on the back and say, you know, you're in the right place, keep coming back. You know? And he's standing there going, when do we get to the not drinking? How do I not drink? You know, I understand you're getting a divorce and you're losing it. Sorry, there I go again. But, you know, I really, that term spiritual malady, there's a lot of terms that just didn't touch me. But that, when I say spiritual malady, I never really felt it. But when you stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about that hole in my middle, everybody in the room knows what you're talking about. And to me, that's the spiritual malady. That's the problem that I was suffering from beginning in elementary school. Even though I was still batting number four and pitching and playing right guard and, you know, high academics and all that stuff, I had that hole working. And the first thing I ever got my hands on to try to fill that hole with was cream gravy. There just wasn't any booze in the house, you know. And if you're in a pinch, you know, you can knock yourself out with white bread and cream gravy. That's another outside issue, you know. Cliff up in Dallas told me one time that there's a lot of things you can use to treat the spiritual malady. The problem is they all start another 12-step fellowship. There's Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, you know, you name it. It's all stuff that I've used to try to treat that hole. But, you know, I guess I did okay, but then starting around junior high school, it really kind of started slipping off a little bit. And I don't know about it, you know, anybody. I can only talk about my story. I started drinking when I was 16. I thought that was really young, you know. I mean, now people are sobering up at like 8, you know. You're like, oh, who's your daddy? You know, I'm here for a 90-day chip, sir. And God bless them, you know. I mean, you know, I got no guard at the doorway. I've got one of my best friends, PJ, I guess he's 39 and he's 25 years sober, probably. And you know, if you listen to his story, he didn't get here any too early, you know. I mean, he was running it pretty hard before he got here. And I didn't need this program till I was 17. But, I started using it at 16. And, you know, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I believe in our singleness of purpose. I try real hard not to talk about outside issues. And let me just say it's a struggle. But what I can tell you is that everything that I abused alcoholically. And alcoholics couldn't take drugs. And so, we do it alcoholically, you know. You know, it would make a really macho story, you know, to get up here and say, I drank, you know, a half a gallon of whiskey from that day when I was 16 until the day that I had quit. But that wouldn't be true. But what I can swear to you with absolute honesty is that from that day until the day that I got that chip, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded for any reason, under any circumstances. I was an absolute devotee. I wasn't a disco drunk. I'm not two beers and oh dear. I was tearing it to the ground at every opportunity. And there was a long time when I didn't really understand. I remember having 3 years sober and leaving my mother's back door one day. For some reason, the smell of the yard and everything just brought back the memory of what it used to be like when I would be leaving their house. I should also say that I was so mistreated as a child in my household that I ran away from home when I was 28 years old. I'm not putting up with it anymore. But I remembered what it was like coming out of the back door of their house to go get loaded. And I remember thinking, I was 3 years sober, and I remember thinking, why did I have to get so loaded? You know, I didn't have a clear answer. I still remember, though, wondering, and you know, I know a lot more now than I knew then, but I needed to really change the way I felt desperately, and it got worse, and it got worse, and I only knew one way to deal with it, and you know, when you only got a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail after a while, and so whatever it was, I drank at it, and then, you know, we get into that spiral of the waking with the terror and the bewilderment and you can't face it anymore, and then, you know, what do you do in a situation like that? You drink, you know, I mean, that's the only thing I knew to do, so I just drank and drank and drank and drank. But, you know, our book says, the doctor's opinion, you know, the doctor was not an alcoholic, and he was a pretty stately, mild-mannered New York doctor, and you can kind of tell he wasn't an alcoholic in some of the little things he says. There's one paragraph in there where he says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's a little understatement. You know? I like banana pudding. You know, I mean, I love the effect produced by alcohol. I still remember the first time I drank it, and you just go, hey, if you're here and you're alcoholic, I don't have to describe to you what that first drink was like. If you're here and you're Al-Anon, well, welcome you, and I'm glad you're here. I love the Al-Anons, and back in the 80s, it used to be real popular to make jokes about Al-Anons, and I never appreciated that. You know, it's the only group of people that loves us, you know. And if it wasn't for them, we'd be in deep trouble. I've got an Al-Anon story that I hope to get to later. But, you know, I guess the fact about it is that everybody just kind of thought that I was getting too loaded. You know, I had at one point, how can I say this? I had two roommates. Well, I say I had two roommates. I was staying in an apartment where two guys were paying the rent. I needed that money. Thank you. I needed that money for some other stuff. And those outside issues are quite But I remember one of the guys made his living peddling outside issues. And the other guy was my bartender. And both of them thought I was in shame for both guys, and that's not good, the guy that you're spending every $10 you can get your hands on with is going, he watched me take a little glass of orange juice and a half gallon of vodka, take a little sip and a big pull and a little sip and a big pull, and he said, damn, man. And I was like, oh, from you? I can take shame from my mother or my sister, but from my dealer, it's not right. But if you're like me, you wind up starting over a lot, and getting it together. And this time I'm gonna get it together. This time, and one time, I was at Three Stooges had just ended, and the mail was there on the floor in my mother's house. I could still see it, and there was a thing that said, "Credit Union reinstates student loans." And I thought, "Hmm." So I filled out the application, and they sent me a $2,500 student loan, and I moved to Austin, and I moved into these apartments, and the maintenance man at these apartments, his wife had gone to treatment. And he kept coming into the apartments talking about treatment. And I don't know why he thought we were interested in treatment, or hearing about any of this. But he was on what I've come to find out, it was called the Marijuana Maintenance Program. And he was drunk when I got here, but he carried enough message to me to get me here. And he kept talking about this treatment thing. He never mentioned detox. He never mentioned AA. He just mentioned treatment. And he gave me one piece of really bad advice. He said, you might want to go pull a really good drunk before you go to treatment, because they're going to make you not want to drink anymore. And I was like, I'm on it. It's a sound theory. And so I went out, and I was pulling that really good drunk because I was about to go to treatment. And I was about to go to treatment for 9 months. And the thing about it is, and I know I can't be the only one that's experienced this, next week is a good time to go to treatment. Think about it. And sometimes when it gets really bad, by God, I'll go tomorrow, probably tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to go tomorrow, but today was never the day, and tomorrow would come and it would be today, and it's like, maybe tomorrow, and so finally I went to this treatment center, and I didn't know, see, it's a Lexus story. I didn't know what treatment was. I mean, did anybody you drink with talk about, maybe they do now, but I just heard about treatment, and there's a treatment center, and I had it pictured being somewhere between the hospital and a jail, and I figured that you would lay up in the bed, and that they would come in and treat you a little bit, just come back in the afternoon, treat you a little more, and I really didn't know why it was going to take 30 days, but through a 30-day treatment center, but I had room for it in my schedule, so I carved out a 30-day slot, and I went to this place, and I loved stolen credit cards. There's a couple of. I'm going to tell the pajama story, but then I got to go back a little bit. Before I went to this treatment center, I took one of those stolen credit cards. The last one. Funny, I would decide to quit drinking when I'm on the last stolen credit card. I went down to Teich's, it was called. I think it became Foley's later, and that's Macy's. But anyway, it was a department store, and I went in because, in the hospital, you're going to spend a lot of time in the bed. So I went and bought a purple pair of Christian Dior pajamas and matching slippers and a matching robe. You know, and now don't think something tacky. I mean, it was I'm more burgundy. In fact, Mark Benno, a buddy of mine, said, "No, that was Mogan David Red." I figured if I'm going to be up in the bed all this time, you know, let's look good about it, you know. And, you know, I went into my mother's house the other day. I went in her laundry room, and I closed the door, and that robe was on the hanging on the back of the door. I was really disappointed with how much time I got to spend in those pajamas. Every morning, you know, you're up off the bed at 7 a.m. and you couldn't get back on the bed till 10 o'clock that night. And I used to get cluster migraine headaches, and I had 28 migraine headaches during the 30 days I was in treatment. And I'll never forget. I got to tell a story. We've been talking about the Big Book a lot, and hopefully I'll talk a lot more about the Big Book, because that's where the answer lives, that's where the solution is for what was killing me when I got here. But when I was saying that we hear a lot of terms that you're not familiar with when we come in here, and there was a guy right off the street, I mean, just crazy as hell, and he was sitting there. I had a migraine headache, and I'm walking around with an ice pack on my head. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. And in the day room, this is before the internet. Now, some of you may remember encyclopedias. Let's all say it together. But before Google, it was a big deal to have a set of encyclopedias. And they had them, you know, Britannica or something. And there was a little bookcase that had all of them in it. And in the back was this big slot. And it had a world atlas that fit down in it. It was real neat, just up against the wall. So I'm walking around, I got a headache, and here's the crazy bastard sitting at the table. And I walk through, and he's got the world atlas out. And he's flipping through the pages, and he's going, "Man, this is far out." And I was like, "Well, good, dude. I'm glad you're digging it, you know." And I found out later that what had happened was he had gone into the office and he said, "I can't sleep. Do you have anything I can read?" And John Burney had said, "If you want to read, why don't you read the Big Book?" So he was reading the biggest book we had, you know. And so I always have visions of this guy being in a bar stool one day going, "Oh, I went there." Yeah. And, you know, I read the goddamn Big Book. It didn't do anything for me. You know, I can tell you where Yugoslavia is. So that book we're passing around is what we're talking about when we mention the Big Book. Before I got into that treatment center, you know, I had, during that time that I was about to go to treatment, it really started getting sloppy, you know. I mean, when it says that we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol, I don't think that we just tear it to the ground originally because we're self-destructive or anything like that. I mean, there was a time when alcohol kicked ass. I mean, I remember just drinking it going, "We are going to do this a lot." You know, I like this. And the funny thing about it is that it has such a welcome effect on me. The amount of comfort that I get from drinking a whole bunch of alcohol, regular people don't understand, you know. So without somebody explaining the disease of alcoholism to me, you know, I come in here, or I'm out there especially, and people are saying, "You need to not drink," right? And I'm thinking, "You need to shut up," you know, because you don't understand what it does for me. You know, if you knew what it does for me, yeah, okay, I mean, it'll fill that hole, and I'll pay anything for that. But, and I can see why, occasionally I overshoot the mark a little bit, you know, and I wreck the car, or I go to jail, or I lose a job, or I lose a girlfriend, or they take my house, or something like that. But I'll take that deal, you know, for what it does for me. And, you know, if you understood what that drink does for me. You wouldn't say stupid shit like that to me, like, you need to not drink, you know? And so what, that's what I show up here with, is the belief that alcohol is not my problem, right? Alcohol is my solution. It's the only thing that I had ever found in my life that would fill that hole that I had inside of me. And this was the first place I'd ever been where I'd been around people that understood that, you know, what it was like to be willing to cash it all in for that ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. When it started getting bad, I like to talk about the pawn shops. I love pawn shops. It was such a pure equation. You know, you take the shotgun in there, and you hand it to them, and they hand you the money, right? And they give you a little ticket that goes in your pocket. They don't ever go, what do you need this money for? You know? Or, you know, weren't you just in here this morning? You know, or, you know, you've been pouring a lot of stuff. You know, it was straight up. You know, you need money, you got stuff, you take it in, you got the money, bang, here we go. Well, one weak part of that equation was that I didn't own very much stuff. So I had to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that creates hard feelings amongst the family. And this leads into my Illinois story, because what I would do is I would pawn everything, and you would have, and a lot of us, you know, we have a lot of good plans, you know, like the guy with the whiskey and the milk, is that Jim or Fred? That was Jim. It was a damn good plan, you know. I mean, you know, and it seemed like it had. Well, my plan was always that I had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop, you know. So you would pawn stuff, and then you got a lot of time, and you know, you only got to come up with one scam in 90 days. And I'm a pretty creative guy, and that would get everything out. So and that worked pretty well. We rolled with that deal for a while, and it worked great, just like all my other plans. It worked great. Until it quit working. And what happened was, one time in particular, I came out of a blackout. I was a blackout drinker. Several times a week. I drank to blackout on average 3 to 5 nights a week. And I thought I was a pretty damn good driver, because I only wrecked the car every so often. You know, that's another thing that, you know, it starts looking sloppy to them. To me, you know, the judge is going, weren't you just in here 6 months ago? And, you know, and I'm sitting there going, I haven't been arrested for 6 months. I mean, that's holding it together pretty good. You hit a tree here, you ram into somebody there, but for the most part, I was driving pretty damn good for a guy that's in a blackout most of the time. But I came out of this blackout, and I was sitting on the edge of the bed. I had $8 in my pocket. I had pulled a scam that netted enough money to get everything out of the pawn shop. And I came out of this blackout, and I had $8. And I still had this gangster wad of pawn tickets. And I hadn't gotten a damn thing out of the pawn shop. And I didn't remember a thing from the previous 5 days. And one of the guys that I was running with went back over to some place we had visited, and he got cut as soon as they opened the door. So I guess we didn't make a good impression on those people. But I don't know what happened during that 5 days, but it wasn't going getting everything out of the pawn shop. And so here we are in that terrible, horrible place of just, oh, no. You know, I mean, we've all experienced those mornings. And I didn't have anything else to do. My dad was a good man. He was a hard-working man, you know, that none of his stuff was given to him. He worked for it and paid for it, and, you know, he didn't do anything to deserve the kind of treatment he got from his son. But I'd have to go to my dad and say, Dad, if we act now, I can get you a really good deal on all your stuff. For you Al-Anons in the room, I don't mean to make light of that story. I used to make a joke out of that to keep from getting too emotional. Because the reason I tell this story is because of the shame, you know, the shame that we feel before we get here. And what I would have to do was, you know, it would be bad enough if it was, Dad, let's get in the car and go to the pawn shop and get your stuff. But we lived in Dallas, and Dallas is a big town. And what we would have to do is get in the car, and I'd have to say, okay, now we left. We have to go over on Garland Road, you know, and I got some stuff over there, and then we need to go over to Harry Hines, and then we need to go to Oak Cliff, because I left the deer rifle in Oak Cliff, and then he metal detectors out on Buckner Boulevard, and, you know, and so it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. This is where we start talking about alcoholism a little bit. This is where we start talking about powerlessness. Because when we were riding in that car, I would swear to him that I will never do this again. And if I was lying to him, I damn sure didn't know it at the time. Because I meant it with every fiber of my being that I would never do this to him again. Because I knew it was messed up. You know, I was plenty psychotic sometimes, but I knew well enough to know that that was some bad BS there. But we would go get everything out, and, you know, like most of us, if you think about, take a second, think about the worst day of your drinking, right? For most of us, the worst day you ever experienced drinking, what were you doing the next day? Drinking. That's the way it would go for me. I would make it for maybe a day or two, and then I would hit his back door like a cat burglar. And, you know, because I needed money, and I would grab that, and I'd grab it, and I'd go, and then, you know, next thing that, well, the short version of the story is, my father and I made those rounds of the pawn shops three times during that 9 months when I was getting ready to go to treatment. A lot of stuff happened during that 9 month treatment that had never happened to me before. You know, that kind of shame with my family, getting locked out of their house, getting to the point where I didn't know anybody that would loan me $5. And believe me, $5 didn't help me much. But I couldn't get, you know, I was out of resources. So that's how slick I was. That's how cool I was. That's the way I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, was without any answers, not knowing how to get through one day without getting loaded, and just, you know, as well as I knew how to be. Well, I showed up for that treatment center, and you know that willingness, the big book talks about we like to try to get with a guy when he's depressed. He may be more receptive if he's depressed. Well, you know what it is? Because you take me, a guy like me, that on that day is out of answers, I'm completely willing, I'm at a point of complete serenity, and you put me in a treatment center, and 30 days later, I've put on 15 pounds, I'm picking up a 30-day trip, and you can't tell me a goddamn thing. You know, I mean, you know, I got better ideas now. In fact, I could tell you how to run a treatment center better than this one still, you know. But I guess, how are we doing for time? Jesus, I'm still drunk. Well, let me speed it up a little bit. Good grief. Oh, well, what happened was I sobered up in that treatment center. And I worked the steps. And I got real involved. I did the first five steps because you had to do the first five steps as a condition of getting out of the treatment center. And I did the first five steps, and I got really heavily involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what we're doing here tonight. I go to a lot of conferences. Katie and I, we grew up going to stuff. And you learn a lot of stuff when we mix with people and stuff like that. You know, I mean, I talked about when we all went to Wet n Wild. And one of my favorite stories is, you know, you get chances to teach newcomers stuff. My first sponsor, we all went to Wet n Wild one day, and we're up on this tower, and there's this ride where you slide straight down and into a pool of water, and it's like a 110 feet up in the air, this high-speed enema, right now, we, you know, the thing goes up like that in a circle, and we go around, and we're about to be next, you know, I mean, and the wind's blowing, and the tower's kind of moving a little bit, and this guy goes, and he kind of gives him the pull, he's kind of like going, anybody want to go in front of me, you know, and it's a little scary, you know, and Jim looks at me and he goes, you feel that? And I went, yeah. And he goes, that's fear. Identify that feeling. It's going to come up again for you. And I was like, thanks, sponsor. You know, so, you know, you never know when we're going to get to carry the message a little bit there. But, you know, I had AA roommates. I went to AA dances. I had AA coworkers. I dated AA girls. I, you know, everything was AA fellowship. And I'm not knocking the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at all. I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I wasn't doing the work. And the thing I can tell you is that the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will keep you sober right up to the point that you get loaded, you know, because I was not involved in the work. I stopped doing the work when I got out of that treatment center, and if you'd asked me, I would have said I was, you know, 6 and 7. Looking back on it now, that makes no sense, but what had happened to me, and, you know, what I, God dang, where did that time go? I'll just keep talking while y'all are cleaning up. I'm up here talking about my two favorite things, Alcoholics Anonymous and me. Katie was around. Katie and I were best friends for 20 years. And a few years ago, her husband passed away, and I got in a divorce. I was hoping to have more time to talk about that, but we've been dating a while now. It's really, I'm happier than I've ever been. But we used to run around a lot together. You know, she was 26 when she sobered up. I was 28. And we had a big group of people, and we did a lot of stuff, you know, and that was all fun. I got loaded. I'm not going to have a lot of time talking about it. I got loaded with 10 months of sobriety. Because at 10 months, it was a night when I was afraid to sleep in the house with my guns. I've never been suicidal in my life. I've bordered on homicidal many times, but I've never thought about harming myself, other than just with what we do. But that night, it wasn't too long after that that I wound up picking up. And what had happened was, when I look back on it now, I had spent that first period of sobriety thinking that my problem was alcohol, and that this was a program to separate me from alcohol, and that as long as I was separate from alcohol, I was winning. I was getting an A, I was doing the deal, right? So my understanding of the steps at that time was that I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. Clearly, it was, you know, I could look at it and see, you know, I had pending charges, I, you know, had lots of, you know, so then I'm going to come to believe in this higher power that y'all talked about. I'm going to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this higher power. Got no idea what that means, but I'm going to, you know, take my best shot at it. And then in this fourth step, this is my first understanding of the work. In my fourth step, I'm going to get out all the stuff that makes me feel bad, so I'll feel better about me, and then I won't have to drink. And then in the fifth step, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to share this stuff with this person, so now they'll help me with my guilt and shame, and then I won't have to drink because I feel better about me. And then we're going to do 6 and 7. You know, I don't know what that means. But, you know, 8 is where I'm going to make a list of all the people that I don't want to run into because I'll feel better, you know, if I straighten all that stuff out. And then in the 9th step, we go out, And we clean it up, so, you know, why? So I'll feel better about me, right? And now that I feel so good about me, I'm going to do 10 and 11, so keep feeling good about me. And then in 12, I get to go out and tell you about me, right? Now, this is a little oversimplified, but that was kind of my take on the steps then. And I knew that in 10, I really didn't complete the ninth step, and I knew that in 10, I kind of had to keep my stuff sort of straight. If I did something to offend you, I had to clean it up, and so I wouldn't feel guilty, because you know what guilt does, and makes you feel bad about me, and so the only reason I tell is I was in the work. Hey, Tommy, this is my best friend Tommy. The thing about it was that helped my understanding of the whole work. I'd done some work, and I'd worked with some new guys, and I'd gone to some big book studies, and I was drawn to people in the big book, but I don't think I really studied the book. It talks about this being the basic text of our society, and that to show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. But I think what I would do was I would just read that book I would look for stuff that I agree with. You know, has anybody ever read like that? You know, where you read through there and you see stuff, you go, oh yeah, there it is. I got it. Yeah, you know, that's what I said. You know, and then the stuff that I don't agree with, I just kind of shot over it. You know, and I did a lot of that. And when I would talk in meetings, I'd talk about the stuff I agreed with, or I'd talk about the stuff that I disagreed with. But my sponsor now has taught me a thing called the set-aside prayer that has been very, very helpful. And I'll share it if you haven't heard it. But before I read the book, now before I do the work, before I do lunch, there's a little prayer where I'll say, God, please help me set aside everything that I think that I know about this process, about this book, and about your way of life, and help me see what you would have me learn out of what we're covering today. And then we go to work. And it's amazing how, well into sobriety, I was having a really flat period. I was in a commuting marriage where I went to and from New York all the time, and on the outside it looked real good. We had a penthouse apartment in Manhattan and a beach house in the Hamptons, and traveling all over the place. And I was not working with any new people. I was not really going to that many meetings. I wasn't reading the book. I knew I had a big book, and I was pretty sure where it was, but I wasn't reading it. And if you asked me, I'd say, but I'm not thinking about drinking. You know, I mean, I'm not. You know, I might be a little flat. I might not be the happiest I've ever met, but I'm not thinking about drinking. Right? And one day I was sitting in a meeting with Katie. And, you know, usually when Katie raises her hand, I figure I know everything she's going to say, you know, because she is generous with her input with me. And I want to thank you publicly for helping me grow. There's a lot of truth in that. When we talk about selfishness and self-centeredness, that's one of the things that I have noticed is that I have become keen on being able to pick up selfishness and self-centeredness in others. You know, I can't see it in me. Thank you for your help with that, Kevin. The other day I told a story about there was a fire and I had to rush into a burning house and run out and get a fire extinguisher out of the house and went in, this was just 2 weeks ago, and I ran into this burning kitchen and the fire goes out and it's really intense and the fire department comes and it'd been like 30 minutes, you know, since it happened. We're sitting at the dinner table and her son, now if you want to see selfishness and self-centeredness, any of you that have teenage children know what I'm talking about. I finished the story about the burning house and the risk of life and limb and all that stuff. And as soon as I say the last word, Sam goes, this is getting really big. And I go, what? And he goes, I got a bump on my back. And I was just like, oh my God! Well, now see, I enjoy that story. But I enjoyed it enough that I shared it with Katie when I got home, right? And, but what did she say? She says, oh, you didn't find it necessary to share the story about your pickup truck? No. She reminded me of the time that her husband was going in for brain surgery, and I had gotten a new pickup truck that day. And I went down to the hospital, and I demanded that Katie come down and look at my new pickup truck. Now, I'm no less self-centered than Sam is, but I don't see it in me. You know, I can. That's why we have sponsors. You know, and that's why we have people like Jim and Danny Brown and you know, Tommy and people that we can share our stuff with, because they can go, might be a little self-centered, but the reason I say all that is because I drank and I came back in and I sobered up and I had that long flat period, and then when Katie should talk to that meeting that day, because I'm going around, I know I'm not living the promises and you know, anything like that, but I'm not thinking about drinking, right? I've been sober 15, 17 years. I got some merit badges in this society, we've been doing the AA golf tournament for 20 years, and by God, you know, just back off. And Katie says, you know, that when I'm walking around in that flat spot, that what happens for me is God consciousness goes out the window. This God that I've come to know in the third step is completely out the window. Well, what replaces the God's consciousness is self-will. And I don't even see it happening. And I am operating 100% in self-will. And when the heat's on, it's like, don't give me that AA shit right now. I've got a serious problem, you know, that I'm dealing with, you know. And during that time, but the thing that struck me when she was talking about that, she said, you take that guy, I'm in self-will, I don't even know it. And next thing you know, that spiritual malady starts boiling up inside of me again, where I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. Page 52 starts to describe me in sobriety. Have y'all seen the bedevilments? On page 52, see if this has ever described anybody sober. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were afraid of misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we could see newsreels of Leonard Flash? I'm walking around in that period, and I'm saying, I'm not thinking about drinking, but what she said that day in that meeting was, you take that guy, and you let him blow out his knee in a motorcycle wreck, or you let him get back surgery, and they hand him a bottle of Vicodin, and 2 weeks later, he's sitting there going, what the hell happened? You know, there's people I love in this room today that can tell you, you know, how that goes. You know, and that's how we wind up. We lose a lot of people in this fellowship with a lot of time. And, you know, so I like to talk to the newcomer when I talk, but I also like to talk to the people that have got between 3 years and 16 years, and maybe you're not feeling like you're experiencing what this program describes, or what you hear people from the podium talking about experiencing in this program, because I'm telling you, it's still available. If during that time, if you'd come to me and said, you know what you need, Charlie, is Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have said, no, that's not what I need, because I've done Alcoholics Anonymous. I know what Alcoholics Anonymous offers me, and I know what I get out of it, and that's not going to fix what's wrong with me today, but thanks for sharing, you simple son of a bitch. You know, what happened was, we chartered a plane coming in back from Long Island one day, I'm telling you, it's looking good. Private plane, you know, from East Hampton Airport into LaGuardia, and then dinner at Cipriani's, and, you know, I mean, this is, you can't tell me, it's squat. Except that we get out by Shelter Island and the engine quits. And you talk about a whole new meaning of powerlessness. We crashed into the water at night out on Eastern Long Island in a plane with 5-0s on it. And as luck would have it, all the humans survived. My dog drowned. But we were in a plane underwater and the doors wouldn't open. And just everybody got out, but just barely. And it was the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me that was a dramatic change in the direction of my life. And, you know, I got out of that marriage because it wasn't right on a lot of levels, and I'd been kind of, you know, thinking I would eventually be out of it, but I got out of that marriage and I came back, and one of the things that I started noticing is, and at the time I was 17 years sober, I think, that I was so self-centered that I couldn't even have a conversation with you. You know, I couldn't be in the room. I spent about 10 seconds out of a year in the present moment. You know, my mind is whirling around 100 miles an hour, and, you know, and I can't even really be in a conversation. You know, I have to force myself in a conversation to say, how are the kids? Like, and then, you know, while they're answering, I'm going, you know, and my mind is, and I went to John Henry, and I said, I described that amount of self-centeredness to him, and he took me, he said, why don't we go out to the ranch tomorrow and talk to the wino? And you know what? It didn't sound like a good idea, you know? I mean, because I've talked to winos, you know how they do, they want to talk about them. And I want to talk about me. And so, but I said, okay, I'll meet you. And we went out there and we started talking to these guys. And I don't know how people could tell, but it had been a long time since I'd talked in a meeting and anybody come up and said, would you sponsor me? Or if they did, I didn't know what the hell to tell them, you know? You know, I know I'm not the only person in the room that's experiencing that with considerable sobriety. If a new man, I could tell you how to do a relationship. I could give you advice anyway. But I could, you know, work stuff, that kind of stuff. But when you take a brand new drunk, I didn't know what to say anymore. It had been so long since I'd worked with a new drunk, and it scared the crap out of me, to tell you the truth, you know. And there was times when because out there at the ranch, there was guys saying, you know, can I get your phone number, and can I talk to you? And man, I went home and I found that big book. I was pretty sure where it was. But there was a damn good chance that he hadn't made the move to that house. And so I got that book out and I started working with these guys. And there was times when I felt like I was one step ahead of these guys, you know. And I would read the book, I'd say, read the doctor's opinion, you know. And then I'd go home and read the doctor's opinion. About that time, a friend of mine had sobered up in the primary purpose group up in Dallas. And Can I run a few minutes over? Where's Harry? Can I have about 5 minutes extra? Okay. If you got to go, I'm sorry. I can't just drop it off the table right now. You know, a friend of mine had started going to the primary purpose group up in Dallas. This was a friend of mine that in 17 years had gone to the dentist's office and they had given him nitrous oxide. And he had such a spiritual malady going on at the time that he scheduled more dental work that day. And he called me, and he was scared, and I didn't know what to tell him. I didn't know what to tell him. You know what I needed to tell him? Go to a meeting. Right? That's some bullshit. We almost lost Tom. Tom was taking 125 Vicodin a day by the time he showed back up. And he got involved with these people at the primary purpose group in Dallas. And these boys were in a solution. You know, they were in the big book, and they were talking about the spiritual malady and the mental obsession and the physical allergy and why we use like we do. And, you know, and that it's not, you know, just that what happens for me is when I go a period of time without drinking, that mental obsession kicks up to the point where I got no power over that first drink. And that the mental obsession gets strong enough that I'm going to take that first drink, and that's going to kick in that phenomenon of craving that the book talks about. And from that point on, I'm powerless over the second drink and the third drink, and I'm going to drink until I have to stop, and I'm going to stay stopped until I have to drink. And, you know, and given that hopeless condition of mind and body, it says in there that I place myself beyond human aid. And what I've started seeing is that the most important step for me to pound into these guys out at the ranch is step one. Because if I don't understand that hopeless condition of mind and body, I used to raise my hand in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and say, my name is Charlie Parker and I'm an alcoholic. I had no clue what it meant. You know, I didn't understand the physical allergy and the mental obsession. I just knew that I got in a lot of trouble when I drank. But now, if I take a new guy and I walk him through and I say, you know, what this hopeless condition, you know, there's no good news in step one.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, if you get to the end of step one, it says the first requirement is that we had to admit to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. I got to explain to this new guy what that means. The book does it. He ain't going to get it from me handing in the book. So I got to explain to this guy what it means to be an alcoholic. If at the end of me explaining step one to a guy, he's not scared and depressed, either he's not alcoholic or he's psychotic, you know, because you know, what step one means is a death sentence, you know. That's what I try to do with a new guy in the first meeting. I spend about an hour and a half trying to get him a fatal dose of alcoholism, you know, because at the end of that, step two looks really interesting. Right? You know, I mean, if you think about it, the steps roll real smart like that. If I am completely powerless, I place myself beyond human aid, then this God business that they talk about in AA starts looking really interesting. And then we get into step three. I didn't understand, you know, that the deal I'm making with step three is that I'm going to quit playing God. You know, it's not just that I'm turning my will over. I'm out of the God business. You know, I've got to quit playing God. I've got to let Him run things. I'm going to take some action, but I'm trying to get in touch with this higher power that they talk about. If it's the only thing that'll save me, that's what I got to do. Right? So I get back into this work. Well, now it says that this decision, the only thing that'll, you know, it will have no permanent effect unless I follow it with an attempt to clean up the stuff that's blocking me from this higher power. I used to think they were talking about step four. Now I think they're talking about 4 through 10. You know, that's the effort to remove all the crap that's in me. It's like there's this pipe, and I'm on one end, and God's on the other, and my pipe's got, it's full of resentment and fear and guilt and shame and harms to others and that sort of thing. And that's what we're going to do in that inventory is remove enough of that stuff where there's some channel of contact between me and God. Right? But now what happens, though, if I got a sponsor that's really versed in the book, where the magic takes place in that inventory is in the fourth column, you know, because I can tell you who I'm pissed off at and what they did to me. In the third column, I can tell you how it affected me. But when we get into that fourth column, that's why I'm seeing my part in it, the selfishness, the inconsiderate, the self-pity, the dishonesty, the self-seeking, and that sort of thing. And then, and resentment after resentment after resentment after resentment, I'm seeing selfishness, dishonesty, inconsiderate, fear, you know. And then the next one, and then the next one. Well, now when we get to 6 and 7, remember how vague I was saying it was before? Well, now I got real stuff that I'm going to God with. You know, I'm going, God, help me be less dishonest. Make me more considerate. Help me, you know, be, you know, less frightened and that sort of thing. So I got real stuff I'm going to God with in 6 and 7 instead of just this vague prayer of like, God help me be a better dude. You know? and then 8 and 9 is another attempt to clean out the stuff that's blocking me from this higher power. But the thing about it was, and I'm almost done, I missed selfishness in that first pass of the book. I missed it. And, you know, and I'm just stupid enough that I don't even apologize for it. I'll stand up here and tell you, the first time I read through the book, I missed the whole selfishness piece. You know? The book takes a weird left turn at page 60 that I missed. I mean, I just, you know, because we're going along and we're talking about our alcoholism, we're talking about the way it affects me physically and the way it affects the mental obsession and the physical allergy. And then all of a sudden, on page 60, it says, we have to be convinced that any life well on self can hardly be a success. Well, that's only about a couple of pages there, and I just kind of, that was one of those where I just kind of went, let it go. Well, this time, I'm reading through the book, you know, and I'm studying the book, and I'm on the phone with Tom, and I'm on the phone with Danny Brown, and I'm on the phone with people, and I go, hey, Silk is all over this thing, you know? And one day she goes, did you really miss that? You really never saw it before? I went, hmm. She goes, that's some pretty basic shit, Chuck. And I was like, I missed it, you know. I mean, so now I'm seeing, you know, that my real problem is self. My problem never was alcohol, you know. And so I'm in this battle against selfishness and self-will now that keeps going on and on and on. And I keep having new realizations. I'll be working with the sponsee. And, you know, we'll be in the book, and I'm going through the step work with him, and I'll go, holy mackerel, that's a prayer, you know, and you know this guy's going, what the hell has he been doing for 20 years, you know, I mean, you can tell I just saw it for the first time. But with that set-aside prayer, I'm seeing new stuff in that book all the time. And so I guess my message to you would be, if you've got some time in this program and you're not feeling like you're feeling it, there are people around here that will show you how to do it. The magic takes place in working with others. That's the real magic of this program, and it's not going to sound like a good idea. I'm telling you, when I'm telling you right here tonight, you're thinking, no, I'm busy. Now, working with others is the magic that takes place in this program, and you cannot see it coming. I didn't want to do it, and it's just been the joy of my life. You know, I mean, watching, there's a thing in the 12 of 12 where it talks about, I mean, in working with others, where it says, life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you. To have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. I said about 12% of what I wanted to say tonight, but I'm out of time. I'd like to close with this little part on page 100. The thing I can tell you, though, is, seriously, come to Primary Purpose Group on Tuesday nights. We meet in South Austin. We study that book line by line. But what the real magic that happens in there is between the meetings. You find people that are serious about the work, that are into the solution. They're in other meetings, too. But, you know, we've got people that come out of there and they're studying the work. And the real magic takes place between the meetings, before the meeting, after the meeting, and on the phone, and on the emails and stuff between the meetings. But getting around people that are fired up about this work, because you get clarity on the message. And, you know, I've always said, you know, that if a guy has had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you can't keep him out of service work. You don't have to force somebody that's had a spiritual awakening to go out and work with others. You know, you can't stop them. So, it's out there, there's people that will help you, it's okay not to know, you know, I mean, you know, you can get with people, and, you know, you've got something to share with these people, and you can learn together with them, you know, and, you know, we can only transmit what's been transmitted to us, but there is some real magic that's still taking place in this program. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things that came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I appreciate you letting me run over that.